Thanks for that exaggerated introduction, Leo. Let me just start with a disclaimer. I'm not doing Cold Adams. I don't know anything about Cold Adams. I wouldn't know one if I saw one. But I've been kind of voyeuristically attending this workshop and enjoying the talks and being kind of impressed by what people can do. And you know, over the past, I don't know how long this has been running now, maybe 2 months, been having some impressions and trying wondering to myself whether there are any connections between what I've been doing, which is mostly magnetism, people in my group, and Cold Adams. I want to just talk today about a couple of problems. There are really more problems than completed work. I think probably more useful to talk about that in any case, where there seems like some reasonable possibility of connecting. Maybe I guess part of the purpose of these kind of talks is just to let everybody know what everyone else is doing. So before I kind of jump into what I want to talk about, let me mention what I won't talk about, but which also might have some relation to Cold Adams, I don't know. So as I said, we've mostly been doing magnetism. I just want to advertise a little bit so there are people here that if you're interested in these topics, you could talk to. So what I won't talk about so these are subjects that have maybe intersect a little bit with some of the Cold Adams. So I won't talk about thinking about crossovers between 1D and 2D or 3D behavior when you have quasi-one-dimensional or weakly coupled wires, chains, elliptical clouds, I don't know what you call them in Cold Adams. We've been thinking about that, several of us have been thinking about that fairly hard in the context of some frustrated magnets, particularly some beautiful experiments on cesium copper chloride. I think our understanding of this has improved kind of dramatically over the past couple of years, and if you want to know about that, people who are doing all the real work are here. Oleg Starik from University of Utah, sitting up there. Maybe he'll give you a talk about this at some point while he's visiting. And Masanori Kono, who's been visiting here long-term from NIMS in Japan, so in the back row there. So he could tell you about that. Something else I thought was vaguely relevant that I would mention. I don't remember what it was now. The connection of this is pretty weak, but there's something, but if there's time at the end, I'll explain how there might be some connection to Cold Adams. There's something called the central spin problem, which in condensed matter arises when you think about one electron in a quantum dot coupled to a lot of nuclear spins. It turns out there's a lot of interesting quantum dynamics in that problem. We've been thinking about that in that context, but I think there might be some connections to things people are thinking about in Cold Adams, so I won't talk about those, though. Gong Chen, who may or may not be here, I don't know, he's probably not here. He's a grad student here. He's been working with me on that. So let me try and get sort of into what I do want to talk about. This grew out of thinking about coming to a lot of talks, and you know, roughly, I don't know, 30%, 50% of the talks start out by talking about quantum simulators. Evidently, DARPA wants to give you guys a lot of money to simulate the Hubbard model. Good for you, I guess. And then pretty soon thereafter, after telling us all these great things, we usually hear, at least if it's an experimental talk, that there are difficulties which people are working hard to overcome. They're hard to cool, especially fermions. Other problems, so people want to do the Hubbard model. In addition to being hard to cool, if you want to simulate the Hubbard model, one of the problems is that the characteristic exchange energy when you have a large U is actually very small, much less than T or U. And it's hard to get substantial exchange if you want substantial U, and it's even harder to cool below J. Can people read down here? Maybe I shouldn't write this low. No, too low. Okay. It's hard to do that. Other goals that people talk about a lot are simulating exotic phases with cold atoms. I'm probably one of the guilty parties who maybe help push people in that direction. I'm not going to talk really about exotic models or exotic phases today. There are a lot of nice exotic models that people like myself or many others have proposed that could realize very interesting phases of matter with non-abelian quasi-particles or topological order, all kinds of fancy things. Usually they require complex exchanges or off-site interactions. All of which are very hard to make substantial in cold atoms. What I started asking myself, I could take the coward's way out and just say, we'll just wait. Cold atoms are moving so fast that if I wait 2 or 3 years, probably you'll be able to make these things. But I just thought instead, maybe it's interesting to ask, is there anything interesting without this? So that's basically what I want to talk about. Is there interesting physics basically without J, or if you want, where systems are always hotter than J, or if we don't have to talk about magnetic systems without off-site interactions? I think actually that's where I found some connection to things that we've been doing. So there are a couple of problems that kind of intersect this, where we actually have been interested in physics that it is exactly like this. So I'm going to talk about two examples. So the first one is, so both have to do with particles with spin. This one not necessarily, but probably for applications to cold atoms would. So I want to talk about first something called the spin incoherent electron gas in 1D. So this is a problem of one-dimensional, some kind of general phenomena. Maybe I don't have to put electron gas. It's not going to be electrons in cold atoms. Gas in one dimension. So this is a problem of one-dimensional interactions where you see interesting interaction physics even at temperatures, and in fact specifically at temperatures much bigger than characteristic exchange energies. I'll tell you. Wait. I just want to tell you where we're going. Spin incoherent. I'll tell you. Okay. Basically, completely random spins. Okay. I mean, zero exchange. So the second thing I want to talk about is flat band physics. Which is a way of getting seeing very strong interaction effects without any off-site interactions, without any J, like that. So this is maybe a better way to say that is kind of looking for quantum Hall-like physics. Without rotating gases, without magnetic fields, without phases. Okay. So let me start with the first one. And you know, please interrupt me. I didn't prepare very much for this, so I just kind of scratched a few notes down. So this first topic, there's now actually a pretty good reference. So this was everything that I did in this was in conjunction with Greg Feet, who's now at Caltech for a postdoc and moving to UT Austin soon. And he's actually written a review, which is 0611597. So if you want to know anything about this spin incoherent 1D gas, you can read that and probably learn anything. So why did we get interested in this? Well, I worked in 1D systems for a long time. I guess my interest was definitely from the theoretical end, not experimentally motivated, although there I will tell you what the experimental motivation is. And 1D systems are very kind of seductive for the theorist because we have so many fantastic theoretical tools. Lots of field theory, bosonization, exact solutions. You can calculate anything. You can do everything. After a while, you realize it's not that interesting exactly for that reason. We know everything. The theory is well, well developed. So this turned out to be one of the very few areas in which theory of 1D systems is not well developed, and there were a few interesting questions that came up. And I think this was, I should mention, I will tell you about it. So the idea to focus on this regime really came from Kostya Matveyev in a number of very beautiful papers. I'll tell you what he did. So for the cold atom people, the simplest way I can tell you what the physics is I'm talking about here is that this is cold atoms people have a great way of naming things. Well, lots of good historical names that in condensed matter people seem not to come up with so much. So this is essentially what this spin incoherent gas is. This is an example of the, if you want, the Tonks-Girardot regime. Lots of you probably know what the Tonks gas is, or the Girardot limit, with spin. So it's a regime of very, very strong interaction. Between particles with spin, I think, all the work has been on fermions, basically, but I think the same phenomena could happen with bosons. There's been a little bit of work on that, but not very much. That's probably one of the interesting things to think about, how to extend it to that. In 1D. So strong that at least in the range of temperatures that we're interested in, the standard machinery of studying 1D systems, Luttinger liquid theory, doesn't work. If you don't know what a Luttinger liquid is, it doesn't matter. So probably it's good to put it in a little bit of context. Let me put it in a little bit of context for you. So where Matveyev's interest came from in this was actually in thinking about experiments on what's called the 0.7 anomaly. How do you spell anomaly? Not with an M, clearly. In a quantum point contact. So this is something that's been noticed for, 15, 20 years now. I think it was first pointed out by Pepper's group. but now there have been, you know, probably dozens of experimental works on this. So there's a very old phenomena called conductance quantization. It's been known for a long time. Probably most of you know about it. It occurs if you have some big Fermi gas, two big Fermi gases, reservoirs that are connected by some narrow constriction. So you can make this in a semiconductor structure by putting some gates down on top of an electron gas and increasing the potential on those gates to push more and more electrons off. So you constrict it more and more to some narrow region, and eventually when that region is very narrow, there are only a few standing wave modes that can fit in there that have enough energy to be occupied. So as you, if you look at the conductance, at low temperatures you start to see steps. Each one of those steps, due to old theory, I don't know, Landauer probably, maybe even earlier than that, one knows that these steps occur in units of the conductance quantum, 2E squared over H. And every step corresponds to the depopulation of one of these different standing wave modes in here. So each standing wave mode can conduct 2E squared over H, and that's, you can understand that just from thinking about non-interacting electrons and scattering of electrons from one reservoir to another. So without interactions, what you'd expect to happen is eventually you have only one standing wave mode that can be occupied. Conductance gets to 2E squared over H. And you increase the potential even more. You push the last electron out of there, and it drops down to zero. So this, try and draw it so it looks proper. So what actually happens in nice, clean quantum point contacts is you start to see, in some range of temperatures, you see a little bit of a shoulder here, and then it comes down finally. It never is a really well-developed step, but they see this thing, and it occurred at a value of about 0.7 times 2e squared over h. And there was a speculation that this was some kind of quasi-plateau. To date, no one really understands this. There's no definitive proof of what this thing is, but there are various speculations. Some people think it has to do with some kind of Kondo effect. Some people think it has to do with spontaneous ferromagnetism. Matveyev had a very kind of clever minimalist idea. It's based also on another observation, which is after a while people, so these are rather smooth things. It's not clear how big really the region is in which one has one single mode that's populated. But you can imagine, and people have done this experimentally, trying to make longer constrictions, something like this, where over some long length you just have one mode. And up here it behaves pretty much the same way. You have one, two, you can see these jumps. But you can imagine that once I get down here, I have a regime where there's just sort of a single mode over a long distance, and I can think about this as a real 1D confined 1D electron gas. And what people found in those experiments is that actually the, so this will be hard to see, but the, this should have been at 0.7, I can't draw it. This thing sort of moved down and got a little wider, and you started to see indications of what looked like a little bit better of a plateau, closer to 0.5. There are other weird features of this. One of the weird features is that, unlike all the other plateaus, which get sharper and sharper the more you cool them, this one gets sharp at some intermediate temperature and then starts smearing out again when you cool it lower. So somehow temperature is important in here. So Matveyev came up with a kind of clever idea, which I think is, you know, even if it's not right, it's beautiful and has a good chance of being right, which is that this conductance plateau reflects this spin incoherent regime. So how should you think about this? So from this picture, what you're doing as you increase the voltage is successively removing electrons from this region. So let's think about it as a 1D wire. You have basically a 1D electron gas. at low density. So there's very old reasoning in solid state physics that tells you that it.
What does it mean low density?
Low density means that RS is large. So I'll say, so low means that. So let me just say it. So if you think about a truly 1D electron gas, so you have only one occupied mode, you would say that the you have a Hamiltonian, which is k squared over 2m, I guess plus. Maybe some dielectric constant. Something like this, essentially. Okay, this thing is probably smoothed out on short distances because of the width of the quantum wire. But so this is a kind of classic problem. It's jellium, but in one dimension. And this Hamiltonian has just one dimensionless parameter, which is called the dimensionless, usually called RS. Essentially, this is the distance between electrons in ratio to the Bohr radius. Okay. So the point is that in quantum mechanics, the wave vector is the momentum operator is h bar times a gradient, so it has dimensions basically of 1 over length, scales like 1 over length. So the kinetic energy, if you think about this distance between electrons, if the typical distance between electrons is a, the kinetic energy decreases as 1 over a squared, but the Coulomb energy only decreases as 1 over a. So when the electron gas gets very dilute, the Coulomb energy becomes much larger than the kinetic energy. So that's so that when these are comparable, that's the Bohr radius. These are the same parameters that appear in the hydrogen atom. So RS much bigger than 1 is what I mean by low density. The density is, of course, just 1 over A. So in 2 or 3 dimensions, if you have the same scaling works, okay, nothing changes except the coordinates are higher dimensional. In 2 or 3 dimensions, what you expect to happen, is that a question, or are you just stretching?
I wasn't stretching. I guess I just want to ask, so in these systems, the interaction is really is Coulomb-like?
Or yeah, it's Coulomb-like. Yeah.
Even though you have these contacts and they don't screen it, they don't provide enough screening.
There's some screening, but it's not that important. I mean, the screening length is usually much longer than the distance between the electrons and the wire. But
Is this Coulomb for importance?
It won't be important for what I say. It's important for this that this phenomena happens at low density in this particular experiment, but. I'll tell you that this regime is much more general.
You just need to have Coulomb energy higher.
You need to have basically interaction energy very large. So I'll give you some other examples where you have a completely local interaction where you also get in this regime. So there's no necessity to have long-range interaction to see this physics, but it just happens in the electron gas.
So the thickness should be so small that it will not help three-dimensional screening, correct?
The thickness of the 2D electron gas, or the...
Yeah, in metal, the screening length is very small.
Sure, yeah, right. So these are low-density 2D systems, and the gates are not that close, but, okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not claiming this is necessarily correct for the... this is more by way of introduction. We'll try to get into this and talk about the physics of these things. So what happens? Well, in higher dimensions, it's pretty easy to understand, and more or less, it's still true in 1D. If potential energy is dominant, then, to first approximation, you would neglect the kinetic energy in the Hamiltonian and just minimize the potential energy. If you do that, if there's no momentum, we neglect this term in the Hamiltonian, then X is a good quantum number. So the ground state will be a position eigenstate, and the minimum energy situation will be some regular lattice, and that's what's called the Wigner crystal. Now in 2D and 3D, at large enough RS, one really has a long-range ordered Wigner crystal. In 1D, not quite. The Merman-Wagner theorem prohibits you having long-range order even at zero temperature for the Wigner crystal, but you have sort of quasi, you have a quasi Wigner crystal regime. So you can think of the electrons pretty much maintaining a almost constant separation between each other.
Are you going to speak about finite lengths or infinite lengths?
A little bit of both.
In infinite lengths, a one-dimensional crystal is unstable with respect to.
That's why I said quasi. Don't worry. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. That's a technicality for this purpose. This is certainly correctly describes all the short-range physics. You basically have electrons that maintain equal distance, more or less, between each other. And if you want to think quantum mechanically, each one exerts its potential on any given electron. So this electron sits in some kind of self-consistent potential minima due to all the other electrons, and the height of this potential that this guy sees is of order E squared over epsilon A. Okay. And this is much larger than its characteristic kinetic energy, so it, to a good approximation, just sits in some localized state in here. Okay. Now, of course, this is a finite barrier, even though it's large, so there's some tunneling amplitude to, for an electron to be able to tunnel through the barrier. But the tunneling amplitude will be exponentially small in some WKB thing. It turns out to go like square root of RS, I think. So it's exponentially small, and basically no tunneling. If there's no tunneling, then the spins are completely uncorrelated with one another. The only way the spins can become correlated is for these electrons to exchange in some way. So it's, you really have exponentially weak exchange. Of roughly that order. Okay. So I'll talk about some exchange energy J. So what you have is a situation where the kind of characteristic exchange energy is much, much weaker than either the Coulomb energy
just by tunneling.
Yeah. Or it would be much weaker than, you know, the characteristic Fermi energy if you were to assign a Fermi energy to this. Any energy associated with charge of the system would be much, much larger than J. So then there's a broad regime of temperatures where a temperature is much larger than J. So there's basically whatever weak tunneling can establish some correlations between these spins is much too weak to overcome the thermal fluctuations of the system. So the spins are basically completely random and don't have any real dynamics of their own. But on the other hand, the temperature can still be small compared to all these energies. Okay. So if you think about it as a Wigner crystal, this condition means, if you want, that the temperature is low compared to the Debye frequency of that crystal. So the crystal is behaving quantum mechanically. So we'd say the charge dynamics is quantum, but the spin is just, so this is what I meant by incoherent. It's probably a bad use of the term, just random, but. All right. What Matveya did was give some kind of very clever argument, not entirely satisfactory. So I would say there's not really universal agreement that this is correct. But so he said, okay, let's consider this wire now. Let's assume that in a central region, the density is low enough to be in this regime, so that this J would be much less than KT out here. But outside, we're essentially non-interacting. Whatever you would call J would be basically there's only one energy scale, the Fermi energy, which could be much bigger than KT. And the idea is that this confining potential varies very smoothly. So he said, well, let's think about the system this way. Let's think about just a Wigner crystal in this system. And on every site, we'll put a spin, whatever they're doing. And they interact by a J that depends on the position. In here, J is very small, and out here, J is very big. And he says, okay, let's imagine we run a current through, as you do in the conductance measurement. When you run a current through, these electrons slide through. So somewhere out here, the electrons are very correlated. They get into this weird region where they shouldn't be correlated anymore, and then they come out again. And he made some clever argument, which I won't try and reproduce.
Matveyev,
yeah. I basically don't want to give you too much of the actual details of any of the theory, because I just want to tell you about the problem and what we know. If you press me, I can. So the argument was that in this situation, actually, the conductance goes to E squared over H. This is 1/2 of 2E squared over H, provided these conditions are met. Okay. And the basic idea is that out here, there's a certain bandwidth for spin excitations of the electron gas, which is of order J, or the Fermi energy. So, and you have excitations that are excited over some subset of that of order KT. So typical energy for a thermally excited spin excitation out here is of order KT, which is smaller than that bandwidth, so that they exist. But in here, J is so small, there are no excitations of spin of that magnitude. So those excitations actually get reflected when they try and propagate in. There's just no place for them to go. And that reflection leads to a reduction of the conductance by E squared over H. That's sort of the argument.
So can you repeat that?
you won't get it. All right, I'll repeat it, but you still won't get it, probably. So out here, even though temperature is low, there are still some thermally excited excitations, both spin and charge. And consider the spin ones, okay? The spin ones are excited over a range of order KT. And that's, you know, they exist because that range is much smaller than J, the bandwidth of the system. But in here, the bandwidth is actually much smaller than KT. There aren't even excitations of that energy inside this electron gas that carry spin. Okay. So what happens is those excitations, when they try and propagate in, they get reflected out, and that reflection leads to a lowering of the conductance. Yes. Yeah.
So the spin channel.
In a sense, the spin channel doesn't propagate; it gets blocked. Yeah.
So
that's why half becomes one. Okay. That's the argument, roughly. Okay. Yeah, so it is, but spin and charge are not really decoupled here in the sense that, you know, the spin is convected along with the charge. So,
So then you would add that if this constriction is not too long, then maybe there's some probability of them moving through.
Right, right. And so this is a nice picture in the sense that, you know, once KT gets below J, then the conductance will go back up again because those excitations do exist in there. And so that gives you some explanation of why this plateau occurs only at intermediate temperatures and not at lower temperatures. Then it actually, you know, it goes back up to 2E squared over H. Okay.
this would be to a prediction of how low the temperature needs to be.
Yeah, it's a very clear prediction. Yeah, yeah. Okay. But problem is, of course, you don't know the parameters that well. But yeah, yeah. So that that's right. It's of order this J, the minimum J in the center of the.
Experimental, you don't know.
Well, so it's yeah, it's tricky. It's exponential. It's very sensitive. Apart from one set of experiments, most of the experiments really are on these rather smooth point contacts. It's tricky, but okay. So you can ask, are there other signatures that we could use to test this picture? So I'll address that a little bit.
But at very low temperature, and at some point, at low enough energies, this is a Lange liquid.
It is, yeah.
So do I need to think about spin charge separation and having the fact that charge can transport without spin transport?
So you can't use a Luttinger liquid picture in this regime, okay? Because it's you're exciting things well beyond the microscopic scale of exchange here. So it's very short distance physics. Each spin is uncorrelated with its neighbor. There's no way to take some kind of continuum limit in thinking about the spins, okay? At low temperatures, yeah, you can use Luttinger liquid physics. It's
below J.
It's normal and boring, and we won't talk about it. Let me mention, so as I said earlier, this is actually quite general. This same regime is very general. For instance, you would get it in a large U Hubbard model. You would get it just in the continuum 1D electron gas with infinite strength delta function interactions as well. So if you just take a large U Hubbard model, then the characteristic energy for exchange J is of order T squared over U. So you can easily have that this is much less than KT, but that KT is much less than T or U. Okay. In fact, you know, simple limit, that really is this Tonk-Girardot limit if you take u to infinity. It's usually people say, well, we can regard then, suppose you take u equals infinity, then this is just zero. Okay. You could say, well, then our whatever particles we have, they just behave like, quote, free fermions. Okay. So if we had spin up and spin down electrons, once u is infinity, they can't pass through one another anyway. They're just impenetrable particles, just like the up or the down particles separately, and they behave. And that's true. It was a well-known thing that bosons, spinless bosons with infinite strength interactions, behave like free fermions. That's his Tonk's regime. But it's only true if you ask certain questions. It's true if if you don't add or remove particles. Doesn't matter. If it's zero, it doesn't matter what it is. Okay. Doesn't matter. We're talking about physics that occurs when we can completely neglect exchange. Okay. Just take large U model. It could be bosons or fermions. It doesn't actually matter. I mostly talk about fermions because I've worked on that. So that, you know, if you want a reason for this is if you have a bunch of particles along a line and you say, okay, they have some spin configuration, whatever they are, but if they can't penetrate one another, then that's the order of spin never changes. The only thing that changes is the position of each of the particles. So you can completely specify the quantum dynamics, provided the particles aren't added or removed from the system by just giving their coordinates only. And those behave just like free fermions because they're impenetrable. Okay. But if you start actually taking a particle out and putting it back in somewhere, or like Matveyev does, he takes it out at the end and puts one in at the other end, then it's no longer so obvious. That's the, so Matveyev's calculation is one example of that. Another interesting question, so this is where we got interested in this, was what about tunneling? Okay. Let's see, I'm going pretty long. Tunneling or photo emission. So theoretically, you can ask about the Green's function, the 1D electron Green's function, or single particle Green's function. So this is something like taking some particle out, adding a particle, and putting it back in, and asking about that expectation value of this thing. Okay. So now things start to get interesting because you pull a particle out and you put it back somewhere. If temperature is these spin configurations are somehow random, you have to pull a particle out. Obviously, to get this to be non-zero, you better take out and put in this particle with the same spin. But if you pull one out here or add one here and pull another one out somewhere else, there's no guarantee that those regions will have the same spin. And somehow that spin has to either propagate from one position or the other or do something. But spin doesn't propagate. How does this thing behave? So there's some beautiful work by Chayanov and... Go ahead.
Let me ask you this. You have in mind some initial condition. Because otherwise, this Hamiltonian does depend on time, and such a Green function shouldn't depend on time.
Oh, it depends on time, sure.
Why?
There's still dynamics for the electrons.
But dynamics will work only if you fix initial condition that the hole in at the initial moment of time is at some place.
No, you can ask.
Otherwise, this doesn't depend on time. Hamiltonian
usually doesn't depend on time, but the Green's functions do.
Therefore, the Green function can depend on the difference of time.
Yeah, it depends on the difference.
T
minus T zero.
One is
at one's at zero. Yeah, I could put T prime if you want. Sorry.
Sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm not doing anything that fancy. It's simple.
Sorry.
Okay. No. Okay. There it is. Okay, let's see what I want to tell you here. It's great. I'm not going to get past the third page or something. It's not obvious how to attack this. Usually, when people try to understand the behavior of the Green's function, for instance, the tunneling density of states, that's maybe the simplest thing to tell you about. Let me talk about the tunneling density of states. So this is basically the imaginary part of the properly defined Green's function at x equals 0 and at some frequency omega. So this represents the what you would measure in a density of states measurement with a tunnel contact, like an STM, at some local point. One of the very well-known features of, I'll call this A of omega, of a Luttinger liquid. So this is when you have KT much less than J or epsilon F or U, is that this tunneling density of states is strongly suppressed at low energies, goes to zero. This is called the zero bias anomaly. There are various reasons for this. One reason is that when you add an electron, you build up a charge disturbance, and it takes a while for this charge disturbance to propagate out. Another reason is that the elementary excitations of a Luttinger liquid are spin charge separated, so they have very bad overlap with the electron, which you're trying to add. These various reasons lead to this suppression. So it turns out that if you're in this spin incoherent regime, there's a wide range of, so there's still a parameter, but there's a wide range of parameters, strengths of interactions, where you actually see the opposite behavior, where this thing actually has a zero bias divergence. It doesn't really diverge because eventually it gets cut off by temperature, but it gets quite high. Okay.
Eventually, it has to come to zero, right? Ultimately.
Not at non-zero temperature, but. At zero temperature, what would happen is eventually it turns around and there's a peak like this. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So this is quite strange. If you take the U equals infinity Hubbard model, that's what these guys, Chayanov and Svanarev, calculated. They found that this thing went like, I think it goes like 1 over square root of omega log omega. It might be square root of log. It's probably square root of log omega. Did I get it right? That looks right, yeah. Yeah, okay. So what these guys did was basically very tour de force, Spede-Ansatz calculation. It takes about 40 pages of a mathematical physics. It's pretty impressive, a lot of Wigner transformations and analytic continuation, and it's really amazing. They also got general results for this Green's function. Interesting thing to look at is the momentum resolved spectral function as a function of omega. So in a Luttinger liquid, if you sit at some fixed K, what you see is some features here around plus or minus KF, not delta functions, but some kind of power law peaks here, doing some complicated stuff. What happens in the spin incoherent regime is you actually get a very smooth thing, but it's peaked around plus or minus 2 KF. It's kind of paradoxical. So if you look at this momentum, not rather than the local density of states, you see something completely smooth. There's no singular behavior at all. But if you look at the local density of states, you see an enhancement. So here what used to be divergent has been suppressed to something smooth, and here what used to be suppressed becomes divergent. Okay.
Is it some K?
Any K you want, yeah. Sorry, I've plotted something crazy here. I fixed, I don't know what I've plotted. Okay. This is not how I want to do it. Let's look at K at some fixed omega, basically. This is what it looks like. Okay. We can talk about the whole thing, but I don't think that's too much detail.
I can write this some scaling function of omega over TU or something.
Yeah.
But in this region, can you still write some scaling function of omega over TU?
You can if J is smaller than all scales. If you can take the extreme limit, J going to zero here, then you can write scaling functions. Yeah. But you can't scale K, so there's omega over T scaling, but there's no scaling with K.
You're not in the liquid you have. Right?
Yeah, but not in this spin incoherent regime.
Okay. What you draw is when in the spin coherent regime, omega is sufficiently small, it still drops. What you draw is a peak. It's a sharp peak and then drops down.
I drew two things. So this is actually of order J if T equals zero. We can draw two different things, so. This plot is T equals zero, T goes to zero, but always bigger than J. This is a different order of limits, so this is J much less than T, still much, sorry, T, yeah, no, this is the other way around, so T much less than J, much less than U or epsilon F, okay, that's this one. So it's Luttinger liquid. This is the range of Luttinger liquid behavior. It's only over very, very small energies, much less than J. The rest of it is not Luttinger liquid behavior, even at zero temperature.
Did you plot that plunge liquid spectral function as a finite temperature T, can we also get this same?
Generically, no. You'll get this behavior if you choose J to be very small within Luddinger liquid theory, but it doesn't. It's not really valid for this part of it.
But how would it be it also has a GST square over U? Is the Green interaction essential for this strange behavior or not? The Lorentz interaction?
No. Like I said, a Hubbard model is fine. It doesn't matter.
A Hubbard model, the Luddinger liquid can also have finite temperature like
Sure. But the regime of Luddinger liquid behavior is limited to T much less than J of order T squared over U. That's when the Luddinger liquid theory is actually valid in the Hubbard model.
Okay. Why in T less than J?
Trust me.
That's the scaling regime.
The very first thing you do is the band. The band has to be large.
Is the
anyway.
Controlled by T or J?
It's because I got asked questions twice, so I can draw two plots. So this plot is when temperature is much less than J, but J is small. Then this is controlled by J.
But you're interested in the opposite regime.
Well, you can also ask this question.
Yeah.
Okay. Then it doesn't turn around. It just rounds out.
Yeah, yeah. So this curve does not know either T or J. Okay. So saturation is controlled by
T. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, the behavior is different. It
but
saturates.
About J anymore.
This one doesn't know anything about J. Yeah. Yeah.
So what does this all this mean?
Okay.
So you see a tunneling conductance.
Mm-hmm. So you would look for an enhancement in the tunneling conductance.
Some bias.
Yeah. So I mean, let me just give you some words for why this happens. So that the basic reason this happens is that the J is so small and thermal energy is much bigger than J. There's plenty of thermal energy around to flip any spins that you would like. Okay. So there's absolutely no energy cost for flipping spins, essentially. And that means there are a lot of low-energy spin excitations, essentially zero-energy spin excitations. When you add an electron to a system or remove it, you add both charge and spin. And in a Luddinger liquid, it's hard to add the charge because of this Coulomb cost. And in a Luddinger liquid, it's also hard to add the spin. But here, it's actually very easy to add the spin. So because there's so many low-energy spin states, you get this enhancement. Okay, the spin contribution to the electron Green's function actually enhances this thing. That's basically where it comes from. So here, if we look at momentum-dependent properties, we're actually asking about putting an electron in somewhere and pulling it out somewhere else. And in general, the spin configurations are random. It's not that probable that you'll. Okay, that is a little bit harder to explain. I would need probably 5 or 10 minutes, which I could do, I guess. But I wanted to move on to the second topic, so that. The basic idea is that with J so small, spin can't propagate. If you put in spin up here and you want to take it out here, it can't actually propagate from here to there. There's no way for that to happen because there are no exchange processes. You just have to get lucky and find that the electron you put in here itself, it moves there without crossing any other electrons and undergoing any exchange processes. And the probability of that happening when the point you put the electron in and take it out are far apart is actually exponentially small. And that leads to the smoothing of these features. Now, why 2kF rather than kF? Now, that's basically because in this kind of very large U limit, if you want this, as far as the charge dynamics goes, that's the only real dynamics in the system. There's no difference between up and down electrons. So you just have one gas of particles with twice the density of either of the individual species. So twice the density means twice the kF, and that's the characteristic wave vector that shows up. Okay. So
there's such a thing called the two-level systems. It has, understanding of specific heat in gases.
Right.
And it's a low energy.
Yeah, you're right. So there's some anomaly in the.
Which is rather like a.
Yeah, it's somewhat similar. Yeah. Here you can't really separate the charge dynamics. So I told you that Chayanov and Zonarev have calculated this thing in 40 pages of horrific algebra. So let me just mention, I'm not going to explain how it's done, but you can calculate it in about, calculate a more general result for basically arbitrary interactions in about 4 lines of calculation, if you think about it the right way. So you can read this review to tell, learn how to do that, or read our PRL from 2004. Okay. Yeah.
Now, these are not fermions, but atoms with spin S.
Yeah. Same.
One of, right. But power laws will do, okay. So 2KF will change to 2S plus 1KF?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And any power laws, I mean, exponents will be...
Exponents depend on everything, actually. So this one half is not universal. This depends on some other parameters. I could tell you. For aficionados, I'm going to write down the formula. Go ahead, ask the question. Okay, C minus 1. So this exponent in general is given by this this charge parameter Kc of the Luttinger liquid in this way. This reduces to a half for this particular case.
But, yeah, I'd like to see if
it's minus this, I guess. You'd like to see one?
So really the peak diverges or does it get saturated somewhere?
So it depends. So no, it doesn't diverge. So these are the two possible situations you can consider. So if you're at a non-zero temperature, it saturates.
Yeah.
Once it hits that temperature. Okay. If you're at very low temperature, then you hit J eventually, and actually it turns around and comes down to zero. Well, you just evaluate this thing at omega equals J. Okay. J. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Suppose I have a model for this bosonization, I have charge sector and spin sector.
You can't bosonize it in this regime. It's not valid.
We can bosonize that. For spin, the entire chain will change that spin on velocity and the Lagrangian parameter is 1. Do you mean that when the entire chain is large, then velocity becomes very small?
Yeah, so the velocity becomes very small, and once, so there's a length, okay, if you take the spin velocity and you divide it by kT, okay, this is some length, okay, and this Luttinger liquid theory is only valid if this length is, you know, bigger than the lattice spacing, let's say, okay, or the distance between electrons, okay, but when Vs is very small, there's a wide range of temperatures, well, that's not true. If you were to calculate this, you get, you know, it's very quickly happens that this hits the spacing between electrons. No, it's baloney at that point. I mean, there's nothing correct about it. Okay. At lower temperatures, sure, but not there.
So I can understand that your spin on has a very bad band, actually. I can think about the excitations of spins based on lower lattice when it's very small. Is that the correct picture?
Say again?
Basically, like the spin on spectrum is very flat.
Yeah, sure.
Basically, like the thing about all the spin excitations are localized. Basically, it's like you, instead of like the thing about the random or just spin.
Okay, I mean, okay. If you want, yeah. If you want, I mean, you have a whole band and you can build Vanier states out of them, and if they're all accessible by temperature, then you might as well work with those which are localized if you want. I don't know that there's anything really useful you get from that, but maybe if that helps you. Okay. Yeah, I won't argue with that.
When you do this calculations on the Hubbard model, do you need to keep the temperature finite? If you take U plus infinity, you can actually...
Yeah, so you can actually do... What they do actually, they actually just take... They take U to infinity and then T to zero. So you can consider that order of limits and then do all zero temperature calculations after taking U to infinity. And that's a perfectly good way to see all these results except for the crossovers here. You won't see. Okay. Actually, there's been some very recent, more recent work by Glasman and Matveyev and Prosaki, maybe, I don't remember if anyone else who looked at this crossover more generally. You know, why did I mention this thing? It seems to me that this is a pretty natural regime for, you know, a Hubbard-like system or strongly interacting 1D gas in cold atoms. So I don't have much to say about this, but so there are some basic questions that I don't think anyone really knows the answer to. They've been limited. The analog of these fancy Chayanov-Zvonarev calculations have been done for bosons, but not the analog of our simple ones, which are more general anyway. I don't think anyone really knows how this works. It seems to me this is a more accessible experimental regime than the cold, low-temperature regime for strong interactions. The real question would be how to measure it. In this electron systems, these things are maybe two natural ways. One is this conductance measurement, and the other is this tunneling measurement. I don't know if there are things that are analogous to that in cold atoms. The key is you need to do something which is looking at adding or removing particles. Transferring them from one 1D system to another. Incidentally, there are some signatures. There are weak signatures in the momentum distribution function. For fermions or bosons, but that's probably not the best way to look for them. Something I have even less to say about is you could ask similar questions. What about d greater than 1? Okay. So take temperature much bigger than J, but much less than U or T in a Hubbard model. D greater than 1. I mean, that seems like it must be a pretty accessible regime. So there, that's a very interesting problem. That's if you want the U equals infinity Hubbard model in D greater than 1, there are various things that are known. It's known that if you have one hole in there in a square lattice, you get this Nagaoka ferromagnetic state. If you have a very small number of electrons, you get just a metal. What happens in between, no one really knows. So there's a nice problem, very simply formulated. Maybe cold atoms can tell us something about it. We basically know very little about it, theoretically. And it's sort of the baby model behind ITC, some level.
But once you're out of 1D, you can actually go around, right?
Yeah, that's right. So around 1D, we can't use these same. The behavior is dramatically different. So at U equals infinity in 1D, you have no exchange.
Right.
Okay, but this does not imply no exchange around outside of 1D. So you have already this Nagaoka, quote, kinetic ferromagnetism at low doping. So that's quite interesting, I think. It seems to me that that's, if you're looking for interesting physics in lattice systems and cold atoms that people haven't understood really in condensed matter, there's a nice regime to look, which is actually more accessible than the coherent regime.
It wasn't quite focused on spin, but I thought David Hughes was looking at some high temperature, trying to send a Hubbard model at high temperature, looking at charge transport.
Yeah, so there's been some work by various people looking at thermal power, for instance, in high temperature, motivated by the cobaltates. But those are very specific things. I would say not. That's high temperature, really. Okay, so that's at temperature actually comparable to the hopping. So that this is a different regime. It's still low temperature, but bigger than J. Okay. If you want, this is a regime of the TJ model with J equals zero. That's what it is, but yeah.
I have a question about your question one about bosons. Why would they be any different than fermions if U is equal to infinity? When U is infinity, why?
Okay, yeah. So actually, these results depend on the statistics of particles, because once you add and remove particles, they effectively are going around one another. So Green's function actually depends on statistics, even though U is infinity.
Density correlation function.
Yeah, density of states will look quite different. Density-density correlation functions will be identical.
Right.
Yeah. So that actually depends on statistics. Okay, well, so I didn't get to number two. Maybe should I, what should I do, sir? It's 10 after. How long do you guys like to go? I can give you a bird's eye view, 10, 15 minutes of that.
Yeah.
Is that reasonable? Okay.
How people feel.
Is it okay? All right. You can leave if you want. I'm not offended.
Me?
No. You go. Sound pretty excited there, Leo. All right, so I'm going to change gears completely now, get out of 1D, talk a little bit about flat band physics. So I would say this is an area where theoretically we know much less even than this spin incoherent Ludinger liquid, okay? But I can describe again the problem. So again, the connection to cold atoms was, in my mind, was that, it's, if you consider some lattice, it seems to be hard to get substantial J if you put particles with spin, or hard to get substantial nearest neighbor interactions. A lot of people have been interested in doing things like looking for supersolids, et cetera. Usually those need off-site interactions, or they need J's or something. Okay. The problem is that all this interesting interaction physics is usually much less than either U or T or both, and so you have to get very cool to arrange these things. That's also a problem in condensed matter systems like the cuprates. We have all these multiple energy scales. We do have J, which is a lot smaller than U or T, in thinking about the Hubbard model, or TJ model, and somehow you have to get even to lower energy scales much lower than J to really describe the physics of those materials. But there is one example in condensed matter which has been incredibly rich, where there's really only one energy scale. And that's really very nice if you have that situation. So the example I'm sure all of you know about it is the lowest Landau level in a 2D electron gas. So you put 2D electrons in a magnetic field, and the energy levels become completely flat and separated by this cyclotron energy. So there's just this thermodynamically large number of states, of single particle states in each Landau level. So there's basically no kinetic energy and only interaction energy. And at least if interactions are actually smaller, we call it U, then this energy separation between Landau levels, okay, really that should be E squared over distance between electrons for electrons, then the right thing you should think about is the Hamiltonian just projected, just the interaction term of the Hamiltonian projected into the lowest Landau level. That describes the system. So there's only one energy scale, the basic energy scale of this interaction, E squared over A or U. And we know from this example that you get a huge richness of physics. So let me just remind you a little bit about what happens. Yeah.
I could imagine a situation where I have a lattice with one particle per size, and the energy on every side is zero, and then I'll add some interactions, and I'll study, what is the ground state of the system, what are the excited states. And as far as I can see, it completely falls under all the criteria you gave, the system satisfies, but presumably it's not as rich as quantum Pauli effect. So maybe there's
you just have a Hamiltonian with no no kinetic energy.
No kinetic energy. Exactly.
Yeah, sure. Okay, I'll tell you what the difference is. Okay, yeah. So to talk about the difference, I need to say a little bit more about what the states are like in the Landau level. Okay. Yeah, so what are these Landau level states? Let me just give you a bird's eye view of what happens in the lowest Landau level. So things depend strongly on filling between 0 and 1. Okay. So how do you understand it? Well, what do the states look like? Basically, they represent, semi-classically little cyclotron orbits whose size is of order of the magnetic length. If you actually write the wave functions for them, they're Gaussian. Okay, they have some Gaussian width like that. Okay, so they're kind of quasi-localized. I mean, they're localized in a real sense, but of course, any two of them, they still overlap. Okay, they don't have zero overlap. So what happens in the lowest Landau level is below some, and this happens in every Landau level, actually, below some value of nu, it's about 1/7 in the lowest Landau level, the ground states of this Hamiltonian are Wigner crystals. Okay, this has been known for a long time. And the basic reason is you obviously want to minimize the potential energy, and you can minimize it by making it approximately zero, as small as you can, by just having almost no overlap between these one-electron orbitals. Maybe it's better to, let me draw, I think here's a view of the 2D plane. Each one is some kind of fuzzy circle. And you can put them far enough away that they basically don't overlap, and you just minimize the potential energy. So as you start increasing the number of particles, eventually what happens is they get close enough that it's impossible to place them down so that they don't overlap. Okay, that's what happens above 1/7 or so. Okay. Then they start to overlap. They have to overlap. So the simple solution here, which allowed you to minimize the potential energy in Wigner crystals, was just to have each electron sitting in some stationary place just with no interaction with each other, essentially. Once they're overlapping, you can't do that. So what happens instead in the lowest Landau level mostly is you get Laughlin states. You get fractional quantum Hall states, Laughlin liquids. In which the electrons don't occupy fixed positions, but they are very strongly correlated with one another, so that at any given time, two electrons are never in the same place. Okay, so it's not possible to have a static situation where you don't, the electrons don't interact, but at least by correlation, they can reduce their interaction. Okay, so there's a real motivation to develop dynamics for these particles, not to localize them, in order to reduce their interaction. And then once again up here, you just have a few holes and you get Wigner crystals. So this is the key feature that's different from your little model with no kinetic energy, is that they never have to overlap. Okay. Once they have to overlap, then there's good reason for these things to form liquids.
Can I make a comment here?
Yeah, sure.
This boundary 1/7 is actually, the overlap thing of course works, but it's actually sensitive to the details of the Hamiltonian.
Of course.
So I would actually say that once you project the Hamiltonian to the lowest lambda level, it's no longer classical in the sense that it contains non-commuting pieces. Or in his example, the Hamiltonian is trivial that it only contains commuting pieces.
That's
so
true.
In this 1/7 case, if I make the short range part stronger, I can push it way down to 1/20th or even 1/130th. I mean, that's when the Laughlin wave function becomes actually a Wigner crystal itself. So it's actually the 1/1 ratio of two interactions actually is crucial.
No.
For which phase that you are in.
Well, we know the interaction is crucial. We know the long-range part is not crucial, right?
No, that's not true.
Because you can use Haldane pseudopotentials, which are completely local, and get Laughlin states.
You always get a liquid state. if you make a short, ultra short range.
Even better. We don't want solids. They're boring.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so so how is this connected to cold atoms and lattices? Good.
So yeah. There are good criterion which tells us, let's say I came up with a system that has some degenerate level and has some wave functions there, but they don't look like one of all wave functions. Can I stare at them and tell, oh, this guy can be in this interesting state, while those guys, they'll be just...
I wish you could tell me. No, I have no idea. So I'll let me describe a couple of examples very quickly where we know at least some situation where it's Wigner crystal. We can say it actually with more certainty than in the quantum Hall case, but we also know a sort of boundary beyond which at least the simple Wigner crystal states don't exist. We don't really know what happens beyond that boundary. Okay. The lattice systems are actually a little bit easier than this. So there are actually many... I'll skip the motivation. So there are many lattice models with flat bands. It tends to happen on frustrated lattices. So probably the simplest one is the Kagame lattice. I don't know if it's the simplest. It's pretty simple. You just have particles hopping on the nearest neighbor links of the Kagame lattice. Another nice example is what's called the checkerboard lattice. There's no sites at the center. You just have hopping on all the lines here. There's something called the dice lattice, which I won't draw. The pyrochlore in 3D has this feature as well. Many frustrated lattices that are frustrated for antiferromagnetism have these flat bands if you consider hopping models on them. So for instance, if you look at the Kagame lattice and you do a type binding of it, what you'll find is three bands. It looks something like this. I won't even attempt to. And then there's some other band like that. I don't know. Okay. This is if I take just a minus T times CI dag or CJ. It doesn't matter whether these are bosons or fermions. It's just one particle states. But there's one flat band like this. The pyrochlore lattice are two flat bands. A dice lattice is one flat band. I think it's probably one flat band for this. What does it mean when you have a flat band? Just like for quantum Hall, it means there are sort of quasi-localized eigenstates. On a lattice, it's actually simpler because we know from solid-state physics that when you have a band, you can always construct linear combinations, Vanier states, which are localized. And when the band is flat, those are still eigenstates because all the states have the same energy. So in the Kagame, it's actually very simple. What you do is you put amplitude only on one of these hexagons with alternating phase, alternating sign, minus plus, minus plus, minus plus. And then you can see that this is an eigenstate. The reason it's an eigenstate is that if the particle tries to propagate to a site outside this hexagon, there's destructive interference between the minus and plus amplitude, gives zero. On this checkerboard, the same thing happens if you take plus, minus around this square. Pyrochlore, you can do similar things. All these examples are kind of like that. There's also one more model, which is this, a couple more models, these sort of P-band models that we looked at. Kanjung Wu has spent a lot of time looking at. You see flat bands like this. So you can create many of these states. You could put one on this hexagon or any other hexagon, and there. It's easy to see that there's a number of these states which is proportional to the area.
You think that is the flat band?
That is the flat band. Okay.
Another case. It's called Penrose lattice.
The what?
Penrose quartz crystal. Penrose tile has
it. Oh, Penrose. Okay. Yeah, it's probably very similar, actually. It's quite similar to the dice lattice. It's built up of almost the same tiles.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What's the crystal? You actually can define bands.
Well, it's flat.
It's flat. It doesn't matter. Yeah. 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 Okay. I didn't know that. That's.
Are these bands always excited bands? Then on the lowest.
If you put plus here, it's the lowest band. Okay.
But
so.
It's the lowest. It's not somewhere in the middle now.
There are probably some examples where they're in the middle. I don't know. I don't know. For all these examples, it's either the top or the bottom, depending on the sign of the hopping. Okay, so, sorry? The P-band dice lattice, it's in the middle, yeah. Okay, yeah. That one seems to be a little bit special. So there's a couple of amusing things to point out. Let me just mention, I won't tell you about it. But in basically every example here, except the one that Kanjung just mentioned, the P-band dice lattice, there's always another band touching at points, the flat band. And there's very interesting topological reasons why that happens, which I won't explain to you. But so another interesting feature of this is that unlike in the quantum Hall case, where there are these Gaussian tails of the wave function, here these states are really, they're strictly localized. So if you put two of them on different hexagons, they really have zero overlap. And so if you have like a Hubbard model, those particles don't interact at all.
What about the other hexagon that shares the corners?
Yeah, that interacts.
Okay. But that one will also be part of that band?
Yeah. So there's a single particle state there, right? Okay. Yeah. So actually, if you're at low density, you can find exact eigenstates of the Hamiltonian that are exact ground states because the particles don't overlap at all. Okay. So that's analogous to this Wigner crystal regime. And you can do that up to some maximum density, which is kind of close packing of these localized states.
Within
the hexagon, the particle is delocalized, but it's so that's the size of this localized state, if you want. So you can, probably it's Daron. Maybe will have to help me whether I got this thing right.
Yeah, that's right.
It's hard to do something like that. Anyway, I should mention that all this flat band stuff is basically the driving force for this has been Daron Bergman, who's a grad student here and leaving soon for a lucrative career in a lucrative internship with Mathematica and then postdoc at Yale. So that's kind of cute. So what do we know? Well, we know for all these cases, it actually doesn't matter whether these particles are bosons or fermions, whether or not they have spin. There are always these exact Wigner crystal states on all of these lattices. What we don't know anything about is what happens up here. So I think, some of these are probably accessible problems in cold atoms. In cold atoms, these are always, I think in all these examples, these are excited bands. So you would like to look probably at fermions so that you could fill them up, fill up the boring states down here, and just start occupying these flat bands. If you're going to work with fermions and you have only on-site U, obviously need fermions with spin, where there's no U interaction. So you need fermions with spin. So it seems like kind of the simplest problem that has some relevance to cold atoms would be any one of these lattices considered filled with fermions with two hyperfine states at a density, such that one is outside of these Wigner crystal regions. Sorry? No, P-band you don't. Yeah, for P-band you don't because you have two orbitals. I just want to point out you don't need orbitals. I mean, this doesn't require orbital physics. You can have this thing in the S-bands. The P-band thing has some approximations in it that are probably not as well controlled as the approximation of just nearest neighbor hopping in a deep lattice. I think this is probably much more controllable. Sure. There are different questions then. What is? So they're two difficult things. controlling the P-band versus controlling the lattice. I don't know which is more difficult. You know, I mean, there are many of these things, so one can probably cook them up at will.
Yeah, a question based on this analogy with the quantum Hall effect. What would be the analog of the stripe phase in these?
Of the what phase?
Well, if you have stripes or something in the quantum Hall effect. So what would, could it be something like that in these lattice models? Because
It could be, but I don't know. So, but we know nothing basically about. So this is just a problem. I'm not telling you the answer. There could be.
There was this work of Shklovsky and company in the context of quantum Hall effect. So I think which belongs to this regime in between.
It does. Yeah. Sure. So all we know, and you know, what do we know about what happens in 2D electron gas? Well, not a hell of a lot. I mean, there's some, but what we know is that practically anything you can imagine happens in there. There are stripe phases, maybe there are pneumatic phases, there's quantum Hall ferromagnets, there's Laughlin states, there's probably some non-abelian states. All God knows. The more you look at those systems, the more you find. I think if you want to, you want some place to look to discover new physics, it's hard to find something better than some real flat band system with interactions projected into that band. That's the only statement I'm making.
So perhaps it's non-universal and depends on the
universe. Of course it's non-universal. Yeah, of course it's non-universal. Difference between first and second Landau level. But even though it's non-universal, it's, you know, if you look at quantum Hall, it's interesting in every case. I mean, I think, this is a pretty darn simple open problem that would be worth looking at.
What's the topological reason that this thing touch? Is there anything interesting touching?
It's interesting. I'll tell you after other people go, maybe. It'll take, that takes 10 minutes to explain, probably. Yeah.
How do you think that the special system, primary rules of symmetry, is not broken? Different from the ordinary quantum Hall theories.
Yep.
Because that's really some kind of decrease. What kind of nature of this decrease?
Well, we know lots of topological phases of toy models, for instance, that are time reversal invariant. I don't know. As I said, I'm going to present you problems, not solutions. So.
Can you explain to me this plus minus? I just missed that part.
Okay. So just think about a single, write the Schrodinger equation for a single particle hopping on that lattice.
Yeah.
Okay, so the claim is there's an eigenstate where the wave function amplitude on every site is zero except for these six sites. And on these six, so here it's plus some amplitude, minus, plus.
Same amplitude.
Yeah, plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one, plus one, minus one. That's an eigenstate. Actually, any loop like that can make larger loops. Well, so.
The loop has to be even size.
Yeah, it has to be even size. Yeah.
But the loop cannot go over the triangle.
No.
It has to be as I say, even sight loop. There are restrictions. You have to turn by 60 degrees or something. Or zero. No, never turn. Never backtrack like that.
Yeah. So you can. You have really a gap that between flat bands.
Sorry?
You quantum Hall.
Right.
It touched, so it makes it not really, you don't have a gap.
I agree. So that's an interesting question, what that means. But there is a very low density of states that are quite close to that band. I mean, also I can say that, you know, in this range, the ground states of the system lie entirely in the flat band. They don't access those states at all. So these are just exact statements. Actually, not even restricted to small u. You don't need interaction small compared to the bandwidth here or anything. It's just arbitrary u. These are exact ground states. Up here, the magnitude of u compared to the bandwidth will matter, definitely. But what happens? Yeah. So that's a good question. It's an interesting problem to understand if that makes a difference or not. Now, clearly, though, from a variational point of view, if you have the way I would think about this is do a particle hole transformation on it, and then that's the lowest band.
You just change the size of the hole pin.
Yeah.
And you flip it.
Yeah, well, you can do that. for fermions. You just do a particle transformation. You just flip everything over. And then clearly the best thing you can do, if you can, is construct a variational wave function which sits entirely in the flat band. If you can find a good one, basically what Laughlin did, is, then that's a good candidate for a ground state. Okay. But I don't know how to do that.
I mean, this is a flat band situation. I mean, if you fill every states there, do they actually overlap?
They do overlap, yeah, because you can't. So the maximum density is like a third of the states filled. You know, you can't put one here and here, then they would overlap, and that's not an eigenstate anymore. Okay.
But those states do not belong to that flat band.
Yes, they do. So I could put this a single particle on any one of these hexagons. Okay. So there's a multiparticle state that's still an eigenstate if I don't make them overlap. But once I start making them overlap, then I'm going to be forced to superimpose different coverings. Okay, so it'll start quantum fluctuating amongst these states.
Is it possible to actually get rid of the touching and have just an isolated flat band and still have this overlapping kind of localized?
Are you worrying about this thing?
Yeah,
that's a good question. So we only know one model where they don't overlap, which is this where there's no band touching, and that's this P band on the dice lattice. It's a strange model, so I don't have any real
understanding.
Yeah, this is with some further neighbor hoppings or something, right? Yeah. Well, we should stop. Thanks for your attention. I mean.